All right, everybody. Welcome to the debut installment of The Two Brandons. This is writer Brandon Thomas talking with writer Brandon Easton. And we decided to start this podcast series just to talk over issues that are going on in the modern comics and animation industry and how it impacts what we do as writers and storytellers. Along the way, probably we'll have at least some discussion of race and minority representation in comics, which is something that we both have a little experience with, different situations that have happened to us over our respective careers. And we just want to inform. And personally for me, I think that something that I want to do going forward, something that I would like to see, especially amongst the minority creators in comics and animation, is a lot more collaboration and co-branding. I think that overall, there are a lot of people out there doing great work, but I feel that we're a little too separated at times, and that being a little more centralized and being a little more plugged into what everyone is doing is gonna help us get our projects further out into the marketplace so they can find a greater chance of success. So
yeah, I'm agreeing with you. This is Brandon Easton, and I just wanted to co-sign with what Brandon Thomas just said. My issue isn't just the separation of black creators. My issue is that the black geek audience isn't really doing anything to connect with us. I just had another brother out in Atlanta tell me he was at a convention, and it wasn't a black-themed convention, but the black people who were there, they wouldn't stop at his booth. They wouldn't even make eye contact with him. And this is something that many people, not just myself, but a lot of other black independent comic creators have complained about. I mean, this is something that's just real, where I feel that the black geek audience, particularly the black comic reading fan base, they're making an assumption, at least from my perspective, they're making an assumption that black produced independent titles, whether or not it's dealing with race or, you know, diaspora stories, they just assume that it's going to be low quality. And meanwhile, they're sitting there arguing and begging for Marvel and DC to tell more black-themed content, and it hasn't happened, and I'd wager a guess that it's not going to happen. So I'm trying to figure out a way not only just to get black creators to connect better, but also to get black comic book buyers to stop ignoring us. That's a major issue.
Yeah. For people that don't know, we'll have links up that so you can read some of the kind of background and context for this. But this started because I wrote a column that I posted on my Fiction House blog about this very subject, about how there's a lot of conversation and discussion about the lack of black writers at the major comic book companies. But on the other hand, there are a lot of black creators, writers, and artists that are putting out independent projects that are coming out and getting, you know, a pretty good buzz, getting a pretty good, you know, kind of response. And yet it doesn't seem like the sales are really catching up to the response that the projects are supposedly getting. And I feel a very huge disconnect between the two ideas. This idea that, you know, Marvel and DC are not, you know, out there driving the content forward. But on the other hand, some of people's concerns are strictly from the point of view where they only want to read Marvel or DC comics, which is what I believe people are saying a lot. They want to read about black superheroes in the major universes, but they don't really care much about independent comics that are being produced overall, not just, you know, not just black themed content, but independent comics period. And if people can't find, if people can't find that through Marvel and DC, they're throwing their hands up and giving up on the comics market entirely without realizing that there is content out there. And I do realize that it's a little more difficult to find. I mean, I'm completely, you know, I'm a huge, huge comic fan, and I have been for over 20 years now. So it's very, even if I'm not buying a book, I still have a pretty good idea of who's working on that book, what type of work they've done in the past. You know, to me, it's important that I'm fairly knowledgeable about the comics industry and what's going on in it and who's working in it. And I believe that a lot of fans just want to walk into the shop every Wednesday and be handed their Luke Cage book with their perfect creative team attached to it. And if that doesn't exist for them, then, you know, Marvel and DC needs to burn down, and I don't want to have anything to do with comics, and there's nothing for me. When in actuality, there are some people out there that are doing work that needs to be supported. And if we're never going to get that book at Marvel or DC with that creative team that people claim they want to see, if the guys that are working in independent comics now are not able to build a career that is strong, or, you know, that is strong enough to attract interest from the major companies.
And that is the key point. And I can tell you right now, and for those who might not be too familiar with how the comic book industry works in the 21st century, particularly, a lot of the big names, or quote unquote big name writers at, you know, Marvel or DC, or people you've heard of, they usually created a buzz for themselves outside of Marvel and DC first by either having a perfect storm of good reviews and high sales, or just having extraordinary reviews and that creator building a reputation for themselves inside the industry amongst editors. The problem with a lot of black creative folk isn't that the work isn't being positively reviewed, because almost everybody I know, whether it's Brandon Thomas's Miranda Mercury or Jeff Thorne's Genre 19 stuff or Milton Davis's stuff in Atlanta, he has the Griot, it's not a graphic novel stuff, but he does like black-themed superhero-type African-themed adventures. And there's Jason Wise out of Baltimore. I mean, there's a lot of cats who I can't even think off the top of my head, whose work has been positively reviewed. So we've got the reviews on lock, but what we're not getting is the fan interest to get us more juice in the industry. So to kind of reiterate, you need to have positive reviews based on quality work, then have that work find its way into the hands of not just editors, but fans. Because the comic book industry, whatever they say about it, it's still very much a fan-centered industry. People talk, and word of mouth goes an extremely long way with retailers, with casual fans who walk in off the street, and even the hardcore collector. So what we're seeing here is a massive disconnect between black independent comic book creators who have quality work and then the audience. And I don't know what we can do other than, you know, have a $100 million advertising campaign. But, you know, I don't know what we can do to get over this hump, because really that's what it is, man. Because, you know, in previous years, I can say that maybe 4 out of 10 black independently produced books were high quality. 4 out of 10, realistically, because there was a lot of stuff that just wasn't good, to be honest. Right. I mean, but then again, with the independent scene in general, I'd say in general, maybe 4 out of 10 books are any good, and the other 6 are just not very, just garbage.
And that's independent. That can even extend to mainstream comics.
That's what I'm saying. Well, man, that's a whole different conversation. You
know, All right, we'll stay here. We'll stay here.
But I guess what my point is that now, at least from my experience, my direct experience, I can't speak about anybody else, but in my direct experience, it seems that about 7 or 8 out of 10 independently black produced, you know, graphic novels and comics are exceptionally well done. And it's blowing my mind how, like, no one seems to be aware of this. Like, I get into really nasty conversations on Facebook, and some of my Facebook followers will know this, you know, up with people who claim that they shouldn't have to go look for anything. They claim that we think it's going to be like, you know, the comic book version of Tyler Perry stuff. And I'm like, how would you know that if you don't even look at it?
Right.
You know, I go back to the convention scene. Like, there are brothers and sisters out there who go to conventions all the time, spend anywhere between $100 to $5,000 over the course of a weekend.
Oh yeah,
right?
Easily.
And they will spend $0 and spend 0 seconds in front of a booth that has black people in it. And it won't even have to be a comic with black faces on the cover, right? It'll
right.
just be black creators behind the booth, and they won't stop.
Right. 'Cause,
you know what I mean? And I'm just trying to figure out, you know, we have to get over our – because we can't blame white people for this. Because that's something that's like a kind of common thing. We just want to throw it on white folk. You know, you can't blame white people for this because no white man is standing in front of our booths with a gun shooing away black customers. You know, so, I think in some levels it's a lot of self-hate going on right now.
I think there's a lot to that. And I also think that it's one of those things where I think a lot of people – and even, you know, it could be a lot of, I'm sure this happens with a lot of creators, you know, black and white, that are producing independent content. I could even admit to this, you know, I know I have personally done this over my, you know, 10-year voyage into the comics industry, where you spend so much time waiting for the larger companies to validate what it is you're doing. And I believe that extends into the fan base. I believe that some fans are of the mind that, you know, well, you know, if this guy was any good, why isn't he working for Marvel or DC?
Right.
So there must be something deficient right. about his work or his personality or his professionalism, because if he was any good, you know, somebody would have snapped him up by now. So I don't want to spend my money. Like, I don't want to. And that's another big problem that I see kind of throughout this whole issue, is that no one is willing to take a chance.
Right.
No one is willing to go out there and spend the money or put their arm around somebody and right. take them through the process to see if they'll turn into anything. I mean, you have Marvel and DC. I mean, any of the larger companies. I don't just want to pick on Marvel and DC, but
right.
You know, you have a lot of these companies. You have a lot of editors. You have a very diverse talent pool that sometimes you can't see at all. But I mean, there are a lot of writers out there that maybe they're not completely there. Maybe they're not completely formed already. But,
right.
you know, it's kind of like sports. You know, if you find a guy who maybe he's not the perfect fit for you, maybe he's not the exact writer that you're looking for. If you know, if you put your arm around him, if you coach him up, if you give him some guidance and you give him some experience and opportunity, you might be able to turn that writer into somebody. And I see a lot of that happening throughout the industry. I see a lot of companies, you know, putting their arms around guys and saying, you know, this guy is going to be one of our, you know, he's going to be one of our new producers. He's going
right.
to be an earner. You know, we're going to put him through the process, start him out on one shots, put him on miniseries that nobody is going to read, build him up and see what happens to him. And I don't see that happening with a lot of black creators throughout the industry, and or female creators, and anything that you could classify as a minority. I just don't see a lot of kind of decision makers out there saying, like, you know what, let me get this writer and see and give him a year on something and see if I could turn him into something. And
well,
you know,
yeah,
I really think that extends into the fan base. I think when a lot of fans see a product like Miranda Mercury or they see Shadow Law, they may take a mental note of it. Well, hey, you know what? Maybe if that guy gets on a bigger book, I'll go back and I'll check out Miranda Mercury or Shadow Law. But right now, you know, there must be something about his work that's not quite there yet. Otherwise, he would be getting attention from the big time decision makers in the industry.
Yeah. And what, you know, and to piggyback on what you're saying, you know, one of the things that I want a lot of people to understand is there is a process by which editors and writers connect and build at any company. It doesn't have to be Marvel or DC. It could be IDW, Dark Horse, Image, or whatever.
Absolutely.
And one of the things that, you know, and this is also for people who might not know this, because one thing I'll have to say before I get into this is that there's a supreme level of ignorance amongst the fanboy population about how the business actually operates. Like, it blows my mind how many people simply have no concept of the business side of the industry, because it is an industry. It's not just, you know, a hobby. The people are paid. I mean, there's hundreds of millions of dollars changing hands in this situation.
Yes, it is.
And I want to really reiterate that for whoever's listening to this. The comic book industry is a business. It's a microcosm in a lot of ways of Hollywood. It's very political. It's about who you know. It's about developing relationships. So one of the reasons why you might not have a black male specifically, or women of color, or even some white women working in the big houses, so they say, you know, it's because, you know, a lot of the editors, and I'm not saying they're racist or sexist or homophobic or whatever, because I know people at Marvel and DC, as you do.
Yes.
And they're not all bad people. Clearly, they're not. But what happens is folks tend to gravitate toward people like themselves. It's a very natural human thing that happens. But what winds up happening in the long run is the numbers don't reflect the people they know. So if you have an editor who has, let's say, 20 friends who are in their circle, and two of them are black, or two of them are non-white, and the rest of them are white men, then when they reach out to talk about a slot that opens up for an inventory story, which is just like a one-shot book that can take place anytime, it's sort of something that happens when a creative team is late or they're changing creative teams. They need a story to kind of be a transition between the two.
I wrote an inventory story for
exactly. Exactly. So, you know, a lot of times one of the ways you get in is through an inventory story. So what will happen is these editors, who generally are white males, except for a few here and there, you know, they're going to reach out to their buddy who's closest to them, who happens to also be a white male. So when this happens 200 times over the course of, let's say, 10 years or 300 times over 10 years, what you get is a industry predominated, you know, predominated completely by white men in editorial positions as well as writing gigs. And that's what kind of happens. And that's something that you got to look at as well, because it's not always a racist conspiracy, but you got to look at who knows who and how those relationships are built. And sadly, sometimes there are racists and bigots working in editorial, you know, positions at certain companies. I'm not going to say who, people know who they are. And what will happen is they won't hire anybody unless they are a white male. And that's something that you really can't do anything about, you know?
No. No.
Like, what are you going to do? I mean, you know, you can't really stop that, you know?
Yeah. But, you know, on that same point, you know, I wrote a, for those that don't know, I wrote a fill-in issue of Robin a couple of years ago for DC. It was issue 167. And it was actually published after one writer had left the book and before the next guy came on. And the reason why I got that opportunity was because of a relationship. I had a relationship with editor Mike Martz. We worked together at Marvel back in, I think it was 2005, on a Shatterstar book that I scripted over a Rob Liefeld plot. So, you know, me and Mike had a pretty good time working together in that instance. And once he left Marvel and went over to DC, we kept in touch. And The product of that is that they were looking for a new Robin writer, and my favorite comic book character of all time is Tim Drake, who, you know, for people that don't know, is the third Robin who was introduced after they killed off Jason Todd. But obviously, for people that don't know, that doesn't mean anything to you. But right. Tim Drake is my favorite character of all time. And Chuck Dixon, who did some of his greatest work with that character, introducing that character into the DC universe and writing his solo title, he was one of the biggest influences on me actually deciding to make a go at writing comics professionally. But before we get off, Chuck Dixon was coming back onto the book with, I believe it was issue... I think they decided he was going to come back at issue 169. And I had pitched for the book, but obviously, you know, once Chuck Dixon got involved, I believe everybody's pitches went away, yep. not just yep. mine. But right. as a kind of like a consolation prize, I got to write the first issue of this big 2-year pitch that I pitched for the book as a standalone issue. And again, you know, Mike Martz, I mean, if I didn't have that relationship with him already, I there's no chance that I would have gotten an opportunity to write a DC comic about my favorite comic creator of all. And Shatterstar came out in 2005, and this issue of Robin came out in 2007. So these are the type of kind of long-running relationships that you have to build, you know, to have any chance at all of making a go in comics. It's all relationship based. And I know personally I haven't done myself any favors over the years, because when I go to these conventions, you know, I've been going to San Diego Comic-Con, I was going to C2E2 for a while, you know, I'm a very I'm not that guy that's gonna be hanging out at the bar after the show. And that's where a lot of the business and a lot of the relationship building actually happens. And I know personally that because I don't do that, I know that I have a slightly harder road to travel, because it's really hard to get real time in with editors at these shows, because they are so, first of all, everybody is running up to them asking for jobs. Can I write some books? Can I draw some books? And this is their entire day for 4 or 5 days at a time.
Right, exactly.
Combined with, you know, with dinner and lunches with talent. So, you know, these guys are exhausted and they're overwhelmed, and you're just not going to be able to get in enough time with an editor on a show floor to really make an impression. So if you're not going out to, if basically if you're not going to the after party, you know, you're doing yourself a disservice, because then you can only build relationships through face-to-face meetings in a con setting, which is completely frantic and out of control. Or right. you're just emailing back and forth, you know, long distance. So these are the type of things that also need to be considered when, you know, everybody is jumping up and down about the lack of, you know, black writers at these major companies. And not to completely absolve everyone of any, you know, responsibility or accountability, but, you know, my kind of the thrust of this argument I was trying to make with this column is that we all share some of the responsibility for why things are the way they are. You know, it's not right. just the big companies that are shutting everybody out. And it's not just, you know, it's not just that, you know, it's also the fans that, you know, claim that they want this stuff, claim that they want this material, but then when it comes out there, either they don't want to do any legwork to find it, or find some other reason, you know, not to support it. And, you know, I talk specifically about, you know, a writer, you know, I'm not gonna mention him by name, even though he said I could, but I just, you know, I'm not comfortable with it. If you really want to find out about it, you know, you can find out about it. But he was writing a review for a recent Dynamite Entertainment comic that came out called Red Team by Garth Ennis. Garth Ennis and a young artist named Craig Cermak. And Craig Cermak and I worked together on Voltron Year One, which was a prequel companion series to the main Voltron title that I'm writing for Dynamite. And, you know, Craig's been I've known Craig since he was probably like 16 years old. So, you know, I've been watching his, you know, his progress and his growth as an artist. And he's enormously talented. You know, I love the kid. And, I was happy that Dynamite allowed him to do Voltron Year One with me. And we had a lot of fun doing it. So fast forward to Voltron Year One ran its course, and Craig was moved over to Garth Ennis' new book, Red Team, because Dynamite, you know, loves the work that he's doing. So I'm reading a review by a prominent reviewer, blogger online that, mind you, I have a what I consider to be a pretty good personal relationship with. Like, this is not just some guy that's writing. This is a guy that has helped me get the word out about Miranda Mercury. You know, we always try to meet each other for a little bit at cons anytime we're both there. So, you know, this is someone I consider to be, you know, a friend and ally, and who I still do. And he's writing a review about Red Team number one, and he makes a comment that this was the first he had seen of Craig Cermak's work.
Mm.
And it really... You know, I wrote about it. It really, you know, it was kind of like getting kicked in the chest. I mean, it was really, to me, I thought it was pretty hurtful to learn that even this person wasn't reading, you know, the books that I was putting out.
Right.
And, you know, just kind of that idea got extrapolated a little wider, which is why I went ahead and wrote this column. But, you know, there is a lot of that. There is a lot of that going on in the industry, and I don't want to make it sound like it's completely malicious, because I don't think it is, at least not all the time. But there is a kind of casual, I would call it a casual disregard for the work that some minority creators are doing in the independent scene right now, which is just, it's not good, and it's going to lead to the same thing repeating itself 3 or 4 years down the line. We're still going to be talking about what Marvel and DC are doing with minority characters and minority creators, and meanwhile, you know, there are a lot of people out there that are just they're finding some way to not be informed that certain books by certain creators are coming out. And even if they are informed about it, they're choosing to get something else.
Yep.
So, I mean, I don't, I know that only, you know, I know that there's only so much, you know, you and I are going to be able to do talking about it. And, you know, at the end of the day, people are just going to have to, they're just going to have to start buying some of these projects, or we're just going to have to stop talking about it and just read the books that Marvel and DC and other large companies put out, and just let that be that. Because I mean, there's no other recourse for people, because, you know, stuff like this, like what we're doing, this podcast, these columns that we've written. I mean, you wrote a great column a few months ago on bleedingcool.com. You are, you know, you are my mother's new hero. she wanted to make sure to tell me, you know, to tell me to tell you thank you. Thank you for saying that in public.
Right.
Because it's something that... It's something that she's been hearing me say, obviously, privately for several years, and kind of off and on while I, you know, was writing my little column. But, it, you know, and I think that people just need to, I would just like to have, I don't want to say adult conversation because I hate that phrase now, but the fact that people don't even want to entertain a reasonable discussion about these issues and why things are the way they are, I think is what is most concerning to me, because usually when it comes up, when the issue comes up, why aren't there more, you know, black writers working at Marvel or DC? You know, people always want to, they want to kind of dilute the argument by saying right. that, oh, well, you know, these guys are claiming that Marvel and DC are racist, and that's why right. they don't have any black writers there. And that's right. ridiculous, isn't it?
Right. And, yeah, see, and that's exactly what, you know, what I was saying earlier, is that it's not always about racism or white people.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? One thing you said that was absolutely on point, well, many things, but one thing I'll definitely talk about is you mentioned the convention scene and how after the shows, there are meetings at bars and at after parties yep. where a lot of deals are made. And this is something that, once again, a lot of the people who say that they want to break in, they don't seem to know this, even though this is written about extensively.
Yes.
I think that one of the things that really hurts, I don't know why this really, I mean, particularly with black aspiring writers, they don't seem to know anything about using Google to research the industry. Like, they'll ask questions that are so remarkably elementary that I'm like, did you even look this up? Like, you know, you could have looked this up and asked them a question on a much higher level so we can actually help you. I can't help you. Not that I'm like some luminary in the industry,
right.
but I can
right.
give you better advice if you ask me direct questions other than, well, how do I break in? You know, one of the things that's discussed a lot, and every comic book writer I know that has a blog online has written about the convention party, like the convention scene after parties and bar, you know, meetings.
Yep.
Basically what happens is, you know, once the conventions are over, you know, most particularly San Diego, Comic-Con, everybody's in hotels. Every hotel has multiple lounges and penthouse bars and so forth and so on and suites. And sometimes you get lucky and get invited to one of the bigger ones that has actual decision makers at it.
Yep.
Then there are those where you just can walk into, but you have to kind of get through all the cosplayers and all the fanboys to find an editor or somebody who's a decision maker that you can get to know. That's remarkably difficult. And that's really, in my mind, what really hurts a lot of aspiring writers is if you don't have somebody to introduce you into that world, a lot of those people do not want to talk to people they don't know.
Right.
For the reason that you said, when you said all day long, people are like, hey, I need a job. I need a job. Hey, here's a cent. You know, when a person here, I can tell you, man, I'll tell you a quick side story. When I was living in Boston and I was editing a newsletter for this animation company I worked for, I had put a sign in the window saying I was looking for writers. And man, it was like I opened the doorway to a hobo factory. It was like all these people who were just bums were coming in and talking about they wanted to be writers and they didn't have any samples and they had handwritten samples. Some of them drew characters on their resumes, and I'm like, what does this have to do with the job? You know, so I can't imagine, you know, what comic book editors are dealing with when it comes to aspiring writers. So one of the problems is that a lot of editors at conventions do not want to talk to unpublished talent or people they don't know. Like, you could be a published author, but unless your book is something they've heard of, they may not want to talk to you.
Right.
I mean, one of the things that got me past a lot of walls is the fact that I wrote, you know, an episode of Thundercats.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the new one, you know, and that does a lot because you're not just some dude. You're a dude with Hollywood credits.
Mm-hmm.
So it does make a slight difference because
mm-hmm.
it doesn't really, you know, it hasn't really opened a lot of doors for me. But
mm-hmm.
my point in this is that in order to connect to that after party scene, you need to have a gatekeeper open a door for you. Like, have a buddy you know who's cool with one of those people on the inside to introduce you to that person. Otherwise, they will not talk to you. And that's something that really does hurt the aspiring writer. And
mm-hmm.
I really want to make that clear that you need to know people and build
yes.
relationships.
Yes,
you know,
you do.
If you don't know anybody, then you need to take your time and be willing to give away your book for free so that people get to know who you are. I mean, I've given away PDFs of Shadow Law on Twitter, you know, for like weeks at a time. I've given out Lord knows how many physical copies. Maybe some of them ended up in a trash can. Who knows? But my point is that you have to be willing to take the loss as a creator in order to get yourself known, which would eventually lead to a gig, you know, at one of the bigger places, or at least getting a gig at a well-known independent house. And that's extremely important. And I think that the only thing we can really do to try to get more people to buy, you know, independently produced black produced independent comics, I mean, other than, you know, trying harder at conventions, it really is going to fall on the consumer to make the choice to support with their dollars. Because in the end, you know, no matter how much advertising we do, no matter how many hands we shake, if the person still decides to walk away without our book in their hand, not that they're in any way obligated to buy it.
Exactly.
But if you're going to complain that there's not black this and black that, and you don't help support the people on that pipeline, then you're as much to blame as everyone else. Because you can't sit there and blame an editor at Marvel in DC that didn't hire some black writer, because if you're not supporting that black writer,
right, you won't buy that black writer's book. But Marvel exactly. and DC are supposed to get them and put them on Batman.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, realistically, and the thing is that Marvel and DC, and this is a reality, have not shown historically any kind of interest in really doing, a massive black tentpole project within their limits. I mean, Milestone was an aberration, and it's not a knock on Milestone because right. they were fantastic, but Milestone was not something that's a normal occurrence in the comic book industry, which is why people are still talking about Milestone,
because right.
mm-hmm. there has been no real renaissance of that nature. And there are like black conventions in Atlanta and in Philly and Chicago yep. and Detroit and so forth and so on, but the critical mass clearly has not made a difference. We need for there to be a runaway black produced independent graphic novel hit like A Walking Dead or Invincible, both done by Robert Kirkman. Yeah. And it doesn't have to be black characters in it, like only black characters, but it has to be something that a black person has created or a woman has created that's reached super critical mass mm-hmm. in terms of mainstream visibility. Then that person will get offered gigs here and there. But until that happens, you know, what can we say? I mean, you look at Reginald Hudlin, that brother had to do how many movies?
Right.
He did like a ton of movies, you know what I mean?
Yep.
And you have another brother, Eric Wallace, who's a TV writer.
Yep.
You know, you have Felicia Henderson, who was also a television writer and advertiser person, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I that. You know, and the list goes on and on. You know, and so that's kind of my point, that you have to be accomplished, because unfortunately, we don't get the same benefit of the doubt that a white male creator with less credits do. And that goes back to like who you know, whose circle you're in, and how far you're willing to go to remain in that circle.
Right.
And that's really the bottom line. And I hope that whoever listens to this, particularly black comic book readers and hardcore fanboys and fangirls, if you're listening to what I'm saying, you have to understand, and I'll reiterate it again, the only way for a black writer to get enough juice to get a gig at Marvel in DC or even at Dark Horse or IDW or Archaea for that matter, is for that person to build a significant following in terms of sales. Without the sales, there can be no writer at Marvel in DC.
Nope.
And that's really my point. And if people don't get that, then the hell with you, because I can't be any more diplomatic about it. No, really, it's like, This is the truth. This is the unmitigated truth. If you don't get that at this point, then there's something wrong with you. Because we've said, and we're not the only one, but we had to put this down as a recording because people still aren't getting it. No, brother, it's there. You've got to support the people who already exist who are telling the kind of stories you want to see and hear. We're already here. But you have to support us. If you don't support us, then please shut the hell up, like Chris Jericho would say. Shut the hell up. You know, because you're the problem. You know, and I hate to say it like that. and it's possible I could lose fans or potential buyers. I mean, it has to be said, man, because really we've reached a point of just unmitigated whining and crying about Marvel and DC. And I'm like, really? You still don't get it? You still don't get why that this isn't happening? You know, and I mean, I'm sorry. Luke Cage is not representative of the black community to me. Neither is the
I mean, it's not representative of me.
I mean, I don't know anyone who talked like Luke Cage. You know what I mean? Like, and I ain't just talking about the ignorant version of Luke Cage. I mean, even now, like, they've kind of made him, they've given him like a seventh grade reading level now. So he's not sounding as dumb as he used to sound. He doesn't act as dumb as he used to act. But he is no, in any way, a representative of black masculinity. And I'm tired of him and Black Panther being considered the only ones in the pantheon. You know what I mean? Like, it's basically, he can't, why isn't somebody doing Black Panther? Why isn't that, well, I want Luke Cage, I want Black Lightning and Static Shock. And I'm like, okay, those are great characters, but you know what? There's Miranda Mercury.
Well, thank you.
And there's characters created by Jeff Thorne and Vince Moore and, you know, Enrique Carrion, who did Vesho. Vesco
at Image. Jason Wise.
Yeah, Jason Wise, his brother, he's doing over in Baltimore, my hometown. You know, I mean, there's so many people out there. And we're just, I mean, there's a Horseman graphic novel. There's, there's so much. There's Corsairs by Dan McNeil and Charlie Fab Gubil.
Blackjack.
Blackjack, Alex Simmons. I mean, there's
I still have that trade.
God, you know what? I bought all of the Blackjack trades when I lived in Boston because there was an independent bookstore, comic book store in Harvard Square called the Million Year Picnic. And they had all of Alex Simmons' stuff, so I just bought them. And this is before, like, you know, the big, you know, all the big controversies really exploded. But I mean, Alex Simmons is someone whose work, you know, is quality. And once again, there's other people I'm forgetting. You know,
because
so many. And I think that the lesson that should be taken from this is that there are so many black creators right now on an independent level doing incredible stuff that I can't even remember all of them. You know, it's not just like two or three names anymore. There's probably like 50, and 45 of them are good. You know, so I don't know. I mean, I don't know what else to say about this particular subject. I mean, I kind of exhausted everything that's been on my chest. Ultimately, to summarize, you got to support us. Don't walk past us at a convention. If you're at a con and you see, you know, black faces behind a booth, just don't walk past and assume, oh, it's going to suck. I mean, the very least you can do is take a flyer or a postcard.
Everybody has something free that they can hand to you. They have a website that you can go check. I mean, I've even encouraged people, you know, buy the book on Amazon. If you don't want to pay $25 for it, go to Amazon, buy the book for $16. I haven't even kept it. I don't even keep that a secret. I feel like that's that could be another potential barrier to people too. It's like, just buy the book. I don't care how you get it. I don't care how you get it in your hand, but you know, if you want to see more of something like this, you got to buy it. And then also, you know, along those lines, stop waiting for the perfect thing to come along, because I think that's another issue. Like, well, you know, there's something about this that I like, but from Miranda Mercury. I don't like sci-fi comics. I prefer superhero comics. And you just told me Miranda Mercury has no powers. It's like, okay, I understand that. However, you will wait forever. You know, that perfect black character that you're waiting for, you need to create that yourself. Because you're not going to find it just walking through a convention, just walking through Artist Alley, because apparently you're looking for something very specific as far as character, as far as storytelling. Right. But you can't pretend that there isn't quality work being done. I mean, to be honest, if I don't think people should be just, oh, well, there's somebody black, you know, on it. so I should buy it. But here's a good example. Right now I'm finishing up. We'll see. We're going on hiatus, so we'll see. But basically, I'm writing a Voltron book for Dynamite Entertainment, and when we did the first storyline, which ran 6 issues, and then with issue 7, we brought in a brand new artist named N. Stephen Harris. And a lot of people. Know who N. Stephen Harris is. They know the work that he did on the Bat books. He drew Aztec. You know, this is someone that has a pedigree, that has credits, that has worked in the industry for longer than some of us have even been even interested in comics. And when he was announced as the artist on the book, everything erupted. Facebook erupted. Twitter erupted. I tell you, yes. To this day, me typing acclaimed artist N. Stephen Harris to take over Voltron with issue 7, that posting on my blog still remains one of the most clicked on things that I have ever posted.
Wow.
So when I saw that, you know, I thought that we had a really good shot of stabilizing this book and of being able to do it far, far into the future. There is an enormous fan base, you know, for Voltron. There's an enormous fan base for science fiction, giant robots. So I felt pretty comfortable and pretty excited about him coming onto the book. And, you know, the influx of fans that he could bring to the work that we were doing together, which, by the way, would make it possible for us to keep doing it. However, the sales on the book continued to drift downward. I don't know that we ever found our level. And right now, we're going to stop at 12. And Dynamite is going to take a look at it in the next few months and decide whether or not they want to do more, if they want us to do more. And it was just one of those things, you know, that was kind of like the snowball rolling down the hill. I mean, I was so excited, and I was so positive about our future on the book. I'm like, oh, this is great. You know, me and Steven can do this Voltron stuff for 2 years and it'll be great. And we'll produce work that we're proud of and you know, that somebody remembers. And mind you, And look, I have no, you know, Voltron is ending at 12, and I know that it's because of, you know, it could be 7 or 8 reasons why, you know, the book only got to 12 and didn't get to 16 or whatever, or 20 or whatever you want to say. And right. I am not of the mind that, you know, Voltron was curing cancer. You know, was Voltron the best book that was being put out on the shelves? I don't know. I mean, that's for someone else to decide. But I do know that it was a quality work that we worked extremely hard on. And I think that you can see that effort on the page. And I think that if more people would have given it a shot, and this is important, if more people had bought the book instead of just jumping up and down about it on Facebook, then I believe that we would have had a much greater shot of getting entrenched and doing it for a longer period of time. But instead, what happened is the announcement came, everybody got excited about it, and then when the book comes out and we say, hey, it's out today, you should go buy it, everybody points to the next person. Everybody points, well, you know, maybe he'll go buy it. But, you know, I don't know. I can't go buy it either. You know, I don't have any comic shops near me. And with the way that, you know, digital is expanding right now, not to say that digital is a huge piece of the marketplace, but digital matters. I mean, if you can only buy comics digitally, then buy them digitally. But you have to buy them. You just do. If you're really concerned about this, you have to buy it. I mean, it's as simple as that. And I know that as a comic fan, I spend, you know, I don't drink, I don't smoke, I buy comics. That's what I do with my extra money, and I'm not expecting everybody to give up all of their secondary interests in order to buy comics. But I buy a lot of comics, and I buy them for different reasons. I mean, two of my favorite comic books right now that are being put out, they happen to be put out by Marvel, are Daredevil and Hawkeye. I think that those two books are a very good example of kind of what happens when you get the right creative team on a book and just let them run wild. However, I realize every book that I buy, I'm not going to enjoy it to the same extent that I do when I read Matt Fraction's Hawkeye. I mean, does that mean I'm not going to buy that book? No. I mean, I pride myself. I don't know if I'm just trying to create good karma for myself, but I pride myself on being able to find new writers, new artists to support when nobody knows who they are. Right. I don't know if I just want bragging rights. I want to be able to say, man, come on, I've been on that dude since, since whenever. But I just think that, you have to give people a chance. You have to give people a chance. I mean, maybe Voltron issue 9 is not the perfect comic book. It's not your favorite comic book. But you know what? Voltron 14 might be your favorite comic book. I mean, you have to be willing to give people a chance. You have to be able to support the growth of, of new writers, of new careers, and everyone just wants this fully formed, perfect thing just dropped in their lap, and and they don't want to have to pay money for it, or they don't want to have to not get Daredevil or Hawkeye to get some other book, by maybe somebody who's not quite established that's trying to build themselves up. And, I just think that people know what they need to do. I mean, it's kind of a secret that all of the creative side of the equation has kind of been keeping to themselves, something that, and I know I've been keeping it to myself, and something happened where I felt like it needed to be said. I really felt like it needed to be said. I mean, I feel like I've created my own black characters, and I've had the opportunity to work on some of the larger characters at some of the larger companies. And, the Voltron situation was just something very specific to really kind of drive that point home to me. Here is a book, a science fiction comic book, superheroes, giant robots, monsters, being produced by, a black writer, a black artist, and either no one knows, or people do know, but are still finding reasons not to support the book. And this, this whole kind of, well, I didn't know. Well, you have to do your homework. I mean, there was I forget who said it, which is kind of criminal, but, I'm listening to an album, and, the artist is talking about how people are always running up on him in the street talking about, when's your new album coming out? When's your new single coming out? When are you having new product? It's like, you have to do some of the work to keep up with that. You can't rely on having to be told directly by phone call or text message that there's a new book out, with a black writer on it. I mean, it's just, it's ridiculous. I mean, it doesn't take that much work, and you might actually find some more enjoyment in comics instead of sitting around and waiting in vain for Marvel or DC to decide that they want to do Milestone 2, which is just unreasonable and impossible for a lot of different reasons. And the first reason is not, racism, that they just don't, they just don't want to see any black books out there. It's a hugely complicated issue, but what isn't complicated is the fact that you have to buy the books. I mean, you have to buy it. That's it. Don't make excuses. Don't plan to buy it. Everybody has an Amazon wish list. If you have an Amazon wish list with a black book on it, buy that book. Buy it today, right now. Do not wait. Because we've all done it. I mean, I've been doing this for over 20 years. You know, I am not kind of absolving myself of complete responsibility. I've casually overlooked things or decided that, hey, you know what? Maybe I need this, you know, maybe I need this Iron Man book before I need this other thing. But, right. You know, you have to kind of just wean yourself off of that. You have to give people a chance, and you have to support creators and projects with dollars that you want to see more of. You know, this is a long, long road that, you know, and again, when I say this, I don't mean, you know, poor Brandon. You know, I decided to do this. Right. I chose to do it, but right. I had my first comic book published in 2003. And it's almost 10 years later, and I still, and sometimes this is just me being ridiculous, but I still don't have the career that I would like, and sometimes that I feel I deserve. And so if you're not willing, you know, this is a long haul. You know, nobody is going to, well, I won't say nobody, very few people are going to put out their first comic book, you know, and it's amazing, it wins awards, and they just get snapped up by the majors with a, you know, an exclusive contract, and they're just set. You know, that is not very likely. That is the exception. And, you know, a lot of people have been at this for a very long time, and they keep trying, and they keep getting knocked down and getting back up and coming out with new projects, new characters, and they have to be supported. They just have to be supported. Otherwise, it's never going to turn into anything. Otherwise, I'll just be a guy that, you know, for 15 years kind of did stuff here and there and had like a couple creator-owned characters here and there that, you know, a few people liked and wrote nicely about, and that'll be it. You know, it's more than just liking the book. I like a lot of books, but you have to buy it. If you're liking it and buying the book, if you're telling people that there's a book out there that you like, you know, don't keep it a secret. Everybody, you know, knows other people who read comics or watch movies or anything. And just don't keep it a secret. If you find an independent comic project that you like, that, you know, that has a black writer, has black artists, black creators, you know, support it and tell somebody about it.
Right.
And that's it. My super rant is over.
And, well, you know, because we're at an hour already.
Yeah, so we need to probably wrap it up.
Yeah. Well, what I was going to say real quick is that one of the things that you did touch on that I really, really agree is the fact that people will continue to buy something that sucks in the hopes that it gets better rather than take a chance on something new. You know, it's an old joke in the industry how the comic book industry and the WWE, or, you know, World Wrestling Entertainment, people who like wrestling have been saying for 12 years that the WWE has sucked, but they tune in every single Monday to watch Raw, and in the hopes that it'll be better. And you can't really get that in too many industries where you have a situation where fans know your stuff is sucky, but they'll keep watching or buying it in the hopes that it gets better.
Right.
Marvel and DC has a captive audience who will buy, you know, books no matter how bad the quality is, but they keep hoping that next issue is going to be a little bit better than the last one. And it happened to me with X-Men. I used to be a huge X-Men. I mean, Spider-Man is my favorite character of all time, but I stopped buying a lot of stuff for the reason that it sucked. And I just got tired of spending, at that time, $2.99 per issue, when I would just read it and be like, this is not very good. You know what I mean? So it was a thing where I just could not justify spending that kind of money. And that's when I started buying independent books, when I started doing more research. I got my ass on Google, and I sat down, and I was like, okay, what's out there? And I found this massive world of incredibly mature, not sexually mature, but just mature in content. I found a ton of mature material written by people who understood politics and history and human emotion. And I was shocked that I had ignored all that good stuff for so long. So I guess to wrap it up, I would say, you know, I know it's hard when you've been supporting a video game series or a comic book character for like decades.
Or Madden. But,
or, yeah, right. There you go. Because I don't play a lot of video games anymore, but I'm not buying any more Call of Duty games. I'm not buying any more Halo games. I'm not buying any more Maddens. I mean, I'm sorry. I've had my share.
I'd like to say nothing, that, but
I'm done, man.
Madden gets me every year. Every year I tell myself, this is the last Madden I'm going to get. And next August...
the next podcast we do, next episode we do, we should just talk about gaming. Because I have a lot to say about the video games industry.
Okay.
All right. So that's that, man.
That's that. That's Brandon Thomas and Brandon Easton. And that is the first installment of The Two Brandons. And there will be more coming. And hopefully we can turn this into a regular thing. And
It will be. Oh, believe me.
Yeah. Let me stop. I'm trying to, you know, I'm trying not to over promise, but you know, it's a lot of fun. I think we come at things from similar but yet different perspectives, and you know, I hope people can get something out of this. You can get something out of Easton's side of it. I don't know about mine, but you know.
You know, the beautiful thing is you don't have to agree to have something of worth being shared. And, you know, we have different experiences in life and we have different approaches. But, you know, I respect what he has to say, and whoever's going to listen is going to respect what we both have to say.
All right.
All right.
Sounds like a plan, sir.
All right.
All right. We'll see you guys next time.
All right. Take care.
All right.